In 1872, the Colt's Patent Firearms Manufacturing Company developed a weapon they called the Colt Single Action Army Handgun. It's better known as Model 1873, and it's even better known as the Peacemaker. The Model 1873 went through many generations of developments and different caliber sizes, and it was used by the U.S. Army from the late 1800s until being phased out completely in 1941. The popularity of Western movies and the television shows of the 1950s brought the Colt's manufacturing, as the company was then known, back into the forefront when the Peacemaker was used in so many of those Western shows. I find it no small irony that a weapon credited with so much death would be called a peacemaker. Today we're going to look at what true peace is and why and how a Christian should be a peacemaker. But we need to ask the question first, what is peace? Some historians, philosophers consider peace to be the absence of war, and especially so since history is so full of periods of strife and war. And the definition in the dictionary reflects this. One such definition is that peace is freedom from war or a stopping of war. A secondary definition is that it is freedom from public disturbance or disorder, from disagreements or quarrels. But how do you have something that is the absence of something else? Bit of a dichotomy there. To this point of what peace is, it's been said that in all of recorded history that there has only been about 5% of that time that has been at peace. So let's put that into some numbers. This would work out to roughly only about 300 years of peace and about 6,000 years of recorded history. Very small percentage. There's another reference that's similar to this that says in the last 4,000 years there have been only 268 years of peace. And some of this is hard to determine because statistics are not always reliable. What the definition of war is can be fluid depending on who's describing it. How do regional wars factor into this? And can we extrapolate data out for years that we don't have? All these sort of things. But the simple reality is that the years of war overwhelmingly outnumber years of what we would call peace. To follow up on that then, if we're looking at peace and just simply conflict, it's not a complete overview, if you will, or a definition, because we also need to consider conflict in various relationships, especially marriages, families, and things of this nature. But let's look at Isaiah 59 to begin in Scripture today. Why mankind's history has been so full of conflict and so short on peace. Isaiah 59 verse 8 tells us why. It says, "The way of peace they have not known, and there is no justice in their ways. They have made themselves crooked paths. Whoever takes that way shall not know peace." You know, we have arguably the most aggressive prison system in the world in this country. And I've been in the prisons often enough to know that there's no justice. You can have someone that's committed, define them, if you will, lower-level crimes, nonviolent crimes, that in some cases will get more jail time than someone who has actually murdered someone. There's no justice in that. There's no justice in the consistency of time, but that's just one aspect of it. It says when they walk crooked paths, they're not going to know the way of peace, because true peace is more than the absence of violence. You can still have the conflict and not be at war. And it's still very unsettling, isn't it? It can still create a lot of other problems. True peace, then, is an unwillingness to be involved in any conflict that escalates in anger. This is why the scriptures tell us to not let the sun go down on our wrath. It needs to be resolved. But the unfortunate truth is that even within God's church, we've been guilty at many times of violating this outlook, where broken relationships can fester for decades. Sometimes under the surface, sometimes not so much so. But let's go back next to Psalm 34. We're not simply, as Christians, to acknowledge God's standard of peace, that it's more than the absence of war, but that we are also to pursue peace, that it is something, not the absence of something else. in Psalm 34 and in verse 14, David writes this. He says, "Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it." It's not a passive thing then. Because being human beings, having carnal nature, peace doesn't stay, does it? Something can come up, some conflict, circumstances of life can change, we get frustrated, we've had a bad week, you know, any number of things. But we have to remember that we have to pursue it. We have to seek it in order to maintain it. Let's go next back to 1 Peter. The apostles Paul and Peter wrote a great deal about this topic of peace and even conflict, and how we're to view those that are in authority. And that bristles in our modern culture. Authority is not looked at in a very positive light, in many cases rightly so, because it's been misused and not done properly in most cases. But in 1 Peter 2, we're given kind of a list here of things to consider. The 1 Peter 2 here, is the whole chapter is a review of what we as Christians are to keep in mind in terms of how we view rulers and how we relate to each other. So 1 Peter 2, again, verses 1 through 3, Peter writes, "Therefore, laying aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and evil speaking." So we pursue peace by first acknowledging or recognizing when we have these attributes, that we need to set them aside. And it's not just a matter of saying they're not there. That's a bit Pollyanna-ish, isn't it? We need to acknowledge they're there and then do something to change it. And that's verse 2. "So then as newborn babes, desire the pure milk of the word that you may grow thereby." And God has created our bodies in an amazing way, even in terms of the gender. And a mother who is nursing a baby, that breast milk is the best possible source of food they can have for quite some time because it helps their immune system. It has all the nutrients and all of the positive aspects of the mother in terms of being able to fight off infections and all these kind of things. We're to be that way as Christians. So in order to lay aside malice and deceit and hypocrisy and envy and evil speaking, we need to desire the pure milk so that we can grow properly. Verse 3, "If indeed you have tasted that the Lord is gracious." That's another aspect of this whole thing, that we're to follow Christ's example. Well, let me just digress on that a little bit. Do you find it interesting that Christ never had conflict that was not started by him? Not started by someone else. He never initiated any of the conflict. And in most cases, he tried to avoid it. They sought him out for conflict. But even in terms of pursuing peace on his level, what did he do? Oftentimes, he would try to answer their question, usually with another question to get them to think. But he would usually exit as quickly as possible because he knew they had an agenda that wasn't going to be solved by arguing. So it's an interesting thing if you want to do a study to just go back and do that. But let's read verse 13 here in the same chapter, 1 Peter 2 and verse 13. Peter continues here and he says, "Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good." So even if someone's not behaving appropriately, we still have to seek peace. Even when someone is ruling improperly. And that's a challenge, isn't it? It's a challenge we have in our culture. Again, government agencies and so forth have kind of done themselves a disservice over the decades and millennia. Because human nature being what it is, they tend to get selfish and power hungry. But on the other hand, we're to submit to that because it's the proper thing to do. Because God establishes ultimately who reigns. So he says in verse 15, "For this is the will of God." The will of God is that we submit, and there's an element of peacemaking in there. We submit to this, and that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. Which, again, is a lot of the example of what Christ did. Can you imagine what would happen within our nation even the world as a whole, but look at the division we have in this nation. If these verses were respected and practiced. I still remember a feast sermon that was given, I think it was 1986, somewhere back in there. Roxanne and I were in Brno, Czechoslovakia, which was a very interesting feast because Czechoslovakia was still communist at the time. They liked Western money, so they had tourism that would come through. But most of the speakers were from Germany. And I still remember the one pastor giving a sermon on everything that would change in the millennium. And to this point here in 1 Peter, he made the comment, he said, what would change if the whole world just kept one commandment? Well, it's a bit of a misleading question because you can't keep one without keeping them all, can you? But if you truly kept just one, and the example he used, he reached in his pocket, he pulled out a key ring, and I don't remember how many keys he had on there, enough, you know, that it looked like a wad of keys. And he says, all of this is so people don't steal things from me. You know, he kind of jingles them. He says, so they can't take my car, they can't take my yard equipment, they can't get in my house, you know, all the stuff he listed off. Because stealing is not just stealing, right? You're also coveting. You're also taking something that's not someone else's. You're compromising God's instruction because you made other things of God that are more important than this relationship. So this is part of what's being highlighted here in this terms of seeking peace and pursuing it. Let's go to Romans 8 next. If we want to put a fine point on that comment, what I just covered, what if the Church of God practiced those words completely? We would have no conflict in the church. That would be an amazing thing. And we're still human. We're still working through these things. We're still growing into the calling that God has given us. And I think as a whole, as a church, we're doing much better than we did many decades ago. But still, it's worth pondering. What can I do to pursue peace? So in Romans 8 and verse 9, Paul has this to say. He says, but you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. Now anyone who does not have the Spirit of Christ is not his. Yes. So he's talking about being in opposition. Verse 8, that in the flesh we can't please God. So verse 10, and if Christ is in you, the body is dead because of sin, but the Spirit is life because of righteousness. So one aspect of seeking peace and pursuing it is to recognize the carnality that we can still have at times, that we can allow our emotions to get worked up. And usually, the people that know us better are better at that, if they're not careful. So I had four brothers. Okay, you learn very quickly. You don't have to lay a finger on somebody to get them wound up. Right? You know the soft spots. You know the things that you can do to provoke them and get them wound up. And then when they start yelling, you can say, but I didn't do anything. We can do that at times if we're not careful. But we show that we're in opposition to God. Here, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in us, then those things should diminish. Because we're still in the flesh, aren't we? And yet as we allow God's Spirit to grow in us, that diminishes as well. That viewpoint, the things that are common in this world, grow to be less common in us. Our example as Christians is to be peacemakers according to God's standards. But let's look at that commandment, if you will, in Matthew chapter 5. Christ spoke of this in his, what is called the Sermon of the Mount. We've heard some messages on that section, this section recently. But chapters 5, 6, and 7 is this whole discourse, this sermon of Christ's instruction. And at the very beginning are what's called the Beatitudes. It's simply an old English word talking about beautiful attitudes, things that we're to emulate. And Christ talks about all these things about being blessed. But I want to highlight verse 9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. The peacemakers reflect God's nature. And that's a challenge. It's always been a challenge for God's people. But one of the things that has made God's people stand out in the centuries since Jesus Christ came and died for us is this matter of desiring to be peacemakers. They were not engaged in the wars of the culture, the nations around them. They sought to avoid that as much as possible, many times literally leaving countries so they would not be involved in those things. They would not support internal divisions. They didn't get involved in the politics. It's amazing how dividing politics can be. We get so invested in these temporary things. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God, means because we reflect God. We'll take on those attributes and reflect him in that way so that we will be sons and daughters. But again, going back to the modern political environment, some are starting to get worked up as the elections in this country get close. And in my estimation, the sad reality is it doesn't matter who gets elected because it's going to bring a lot of anger. Either side is not going to bend or yield. And it's just going to add fuel to the fire. We can get caught up because we can see various agendas we may not be comfortable with, especially from Scripture. But those things trickle down, don't they? To the local levels, sometimes into our even school elections. We see all kinds of things we would want righted, but this is not the world we're to fix. And we can disagree over those things, but we should never be disagreeable to each other, especially. But here's the thing to think about. We don't consider ourselves radicals, but we are. And I think we're going to be increasingly seen as radical as time progresses because we will not reflect the culture around us. Our calling puts us at odds with the culture around us. We're to stand up for different values and character. We can see this in this simple command, if you will, to be peacemakers. That's challenging, isn't it? I just saw it again this week, driving on the highway, somebody that needed to be on that exit 3 seconds earlier. So they come flying up, go around me, cut in front, and then take the exit. And it's like they didn't get there any faster, and they put all kinds of other things into play that didn't need to be. But are we peacemakers? Does that get us wound up? Anymore, I'm just thankful they didn't do something stupid, like the guy that drove through the red light yesterday as I was out doing errands. Just wasn't even paying attention. But it is a radical calling. Let's go back to 1 Peter. How do we practice this peacemaking then? In 1 Peter 3 and in verse 8, we begin to see some framework that we need to hang this on. So in 1 Peter 3 and verse 8, Peter here says, "Finally, all of you be of one mind." And one of the major aspects of becoming a peacemaker is to seek what is common, what we can agree upon, that we build on our commonalities instead of focusing on our differences. To be of one mind, having compassion for one another, which is another element. Have you ever had, I won't call it, a conversation is not the right word because it tends to be one-sided. Have you ever had somebody come at you and they're just really angry, but they're not angry at you? To have compassion that someone's been wronged or they've had a bad week or circumstances of life or whatever it happens to be, and maybe we're just the safe person to vent to. But to seek that compassion as well, because it says love as brothers. Okay, so I mentioned how brothers can provoke one another, but here's the flip side of that. Nobody else was allowed to do that, right? You're not family. You can't do that. You know, to have that kind of look as well, to have that kind of love. Be tender-hearted, to have that softness, which again in the culture around us is seen as weakness, isn't it? That you would have that kind of tenderness. Be courteous. This is a huge one because there's increasing frequency within the psychology community and sociology and those that study relationships as a whole. One of the major things that will cement a relationship and have it thrive is if they're courteous to each other. And it can be in simple words like thank you and please. We can take that for granted. But to remember to be courteous. And then here's the really big one, verse 9. Not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling. We have expressions like, if you hurt me, I'll hurt you twice as much. That's this, isn't it? This is returning evil for evil, reviling for reviling. And we have the example of Jesus Christ as he was dying, and he could hear all of this. Sometimes we can have a wrong impression of what that crucifixion looked like, but the person being crucified didn't need to be high off the ground. They just needed to be high enough off the ground their feet couldn't touch, right? So that could be a foot or two off the ground. So there would be crowds around. And he's hearing all the people besmirching his character, belittling him, maligning him, making fun of him, even the guys dying with him, which is rather odd to think about. But he did not revile back, did he? Said he did not. Which would be a tough thing to do if you know you haven't done what is being done to you, the reason it's being done to you. Here is the the marching orders. Instead of reviling or returning evil, it says, on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called for this and that you may inherit a blessing. And Peter has sort of ceased to preach and start to meddle here, hasn't he? Because this is really hard to do. That we're supposed to, instead of return evil, return a blessing? Well, why? Because it says so that we can inherit a blessing. Think about the Father and the Son. They didn't have to do any of what we're a part of, did they? So let me use a simple illustration. A man and a wife get married. They're husband and wife now. For the most part, that's probably the most peaceful that relationship is going to be if they have kids, until the kids are grown up and gone and have their own families. But there's still an element of that comes back, though, isn't it? You're at peace. And increasingly, unfortunately, there are a lot of people that get married and they say, we're never going to have kids, because they don't want to lose what they think that peace is. But yet, God is family. He designed us to strive and want family and to be a part of family, that we can inherit a blessing. And so you bless instead. And so even as the Father and the Son decided that they were going to create mankind, they desired to bring into their family, what's the history of mankind? All the noise, all the anger, all the fighting, all the strife. And there have been some positive things. But for the most part, they've had to just show back better than what they've gotten, haven't they? We know that'll change in time as God works out his plans. But again, to inherit a blessing, we need to do these things, to be of one mind, to have compassion, to love his brothers, be tenderhearted, be courteous, to not return tit for tat, and these sort of things. So then verse 11, let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it, which we read earlier. So we're back to this matter of pursuing it, seeking it. And it's not always going to be reciprocated, is it? But yet, as we read here, on the contrary, return a blessing. So the guy wants to speed up and take the exit. What do? You speed up or you slow down? I slow down because it's a real big hassle to get the insurance to fix your car, right? It's not worth the trouble sitting on the side of the highway until the police show up and sort the whole thing out. So sometimes the blessing is just letting it go. Now, you're not going to change them, but that's not our job, is it? But even if somebody is screaming at you, you know, one of the best things you can do to diffuse that, because most people won't know what to do with this, just simply ask them if they're okay. Not with any kind of malice or snideness or any of this snarkiness. They're yelling at you, and when they pause to say, are you okay? Because that's a whole lot of anger, and I don't know what that is about. And they've either got to process it or they've got to walk away. Now, whether you see that as peacemaking or not, at least you're not part of it, and you're trying to return a blessing. Maybe there is something they need to see, and if we've got a good enough relationship, then maybe we can follow through on that. But let's look at this a little further in Psalm 119. What else do we add to this aspect of peacemaking? How do we practice it? So in Psalm 119 and verse 165, David says here, great peace have those who love your law. So another aspect is that we have to keep in the background as a foundation always, what is God's law? Okay, so we know the commandments. We know what we read earlier about not reviling, returning reviling for reviling, evil for evil, and those sort of things. But this aspect of the peace that comes with that. We've got different expressions along that line as well, don't we? So not my circus, not my monkey, not my circus, right? It's not mine to fix. You know, I don't have to be the one that tries to fix it. Great peace have those who love your law, which means we strive to live it, not just know it, but to practice it. And it says nothing causes them to stumble because we keep those things, those spiritual principles, at the forefront. We don't allow those things to begin to change us in a negative way. So, again, peacemaking requires loving God, all aspects of it, which means mercy and faith as well. Micah 6, verse 8, you know, what does God require of us? Okay, well, you can't have mercy or faith without justice, which is the law. But you can't have the law in the absence of mercy and faith either, because then you've just got authoritarianism. So becoming a peacemaker involves this balance, doesn't it? Like so many other things that we're to be a part of. But again, to go back to my earlier point, it is a radical calling. Because if we practice these things, people are not going to know what to do with that. Right? You have the conversations at work, it comes up, maybe it's about elections, politics, whatever's going on in that realm right now. And when you don't get agitated, they don't know what to do with that. But usually what will happen is they'll stop having those conversations with you because you're not feeding it. And again, that's part of a blessing because then you don't have to deal with it moving forward. And maybe they'll begin to soften what they think they need to be worked up about. But we should be beacons of this peace in our personal lives, our families, our reputations. You know, even talking about church history, as I did earlier, the kings and rulers of those nations were at a bit of a conundrum with God's people because they liked their work ethic, they liked their honesty, they liked the strength of their families. They were peaceful people. But when they didn't engage in the culture, they didn't know what to do with that, even though they liked all these other positive things, which comes back to that radicalness that I've talked about. But it also makes us stand out. People like it, even if they don't know what to do with it or don't know what it's about. No one really likes contention. Because it's just draining, isn't it? It's tiring. But again, conflict comes in part from determining to show we are right. Most of these conversations come down to that. And you have to agree with me. So let's look at this in Galatians chapter 6. Again, if we bring this within the church, within our relationships, our families, in Galatians 6 in verse 2, Paul has this to say. He says, I say to you that if you become, I'm sorry, wrong chapter, 6 verse 2, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. As I said earlier, sometimes being a peacemaker is simply willing to hear them out and then move on. Sometimes people just do need to process, and sometimes they need to be reminded, but to bear with that, to be strong enough that you can carry that and hear them out. But we also need to love one another as Christ loved us. So let's look at that in 1 John. 1 John 4 and verse 11. The Apostle John writes here, he says, Beloved, if God so loved us, we ought to also love one another, which goes back to my illustration about Christ as he was being crucified. The love that he exhibited as he was dying to those who were killing him goes against human nature, doesn't it? And what John is saying here is that we are to love that way to each other. So the burdens are not hard to carry if we're looking at them that way. They're not hard to help someone through because, again, we don't own it. We can be a reminder. We can be a support. We can be an encouragement. If we move down to verse 20 here in this chapter, 1 John 4 and verse 20, he goes on to say, if someone says, I love God and hates his brother, he is a liar. Nothing else he says is important. He's a liar because God doesn't know where he stands. He doesn't know what he'll do moving forward. Because if we don't have the love of God and we hate our brother, then we can't love God. Because our brother is made in the image of God, isn't he? all are being called with the potential to be in God's family. So he goes on to say, for he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God who he has not seen? We can't pick and choose. And this division that we're reading here comes down to a lack of peacemaking. All right, so let's go next to Romans chapter 12. Romans 12. Again, adds to this, these various aspects we've talked about up to this point of how we practice peacemaking. Another aspect is, as we touched on in a previous verse, to overcome evil with good. So Romans 12 and verse 20, Paul writes here, therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him drink. For in doing so, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Now, what is this talking about? So we can't feed them and give them something to drink so that we can then punish them. That's the wrong desire. God is asking us to set aside our malice, our hypocrisy, these things we touched on earlier, and provide for someone so that if they don't change, they reap the negative consequences. It doesn't change us. Verse 21, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And again, that goes counter to everything we know in our carnal nature. Because that involves a sacrifice, doesn't it? It might sacrifice justice. It might sacrifice being in a place where we're not feeling pain. All kinds of things. But again, when we don't overcome by evil, rather with good, we reflect God. He sees in us the values, the character that is in him that he values. Let's go back to chapter 5. You know, in Matthew 18, we're good at this as a church, where we'll quote Matthew 18 when it comes to resolving conflict. You know, did you go to your brother? And it's not that we shouldn't. But when we also then go back and reflect on what Peter said to Christ, you know, he came to Christ in that one example, talking about forgiveness. How often should I forgive my brother? So the Jewish tradition, a lot of theologians, historians will say, the Jewish tradition was that they taught you only had to forgive somebody 3 times, and then you could cut them out of your life. They were dead to you. So what did Peter do? Peter said 7, right? I only have to forgive him 7 times. So Peter thought he was being generous, you know, 3 again in one good measure. You know, so 7, then I can cut him out of my life. And what did Christ say? 70 times 7. Does that mean 490 times? Then we can cut him out of our life. No, it's hyperbole. You know, it's an exaggeration for effect. Forgive and forgive and forgive and forgive. Because that's what God does. Right? How many times have we gone to God with the same request to forgive us for the same sin? And he forgives us. So, Romans 5 and verse 6. Paul again here says, for when we were still without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. It seems that even within his own family, the only two people that probably believed him were his mother and his stepdad. Later, siblings believed, but I can only imagine what the siblings had to say while they were growing up together. Then you look at how many friends Christ had. He only had a few that we could probably intimate that were friends. Lazarus, Martha, Mary show up regularly. They were probably very good friends. Some of the disciples especially, Peter and John, show up regularly. But he went through all of this for humanity, didn't he? Not just for his friends, for himself. He died for the ungodly, which was even us before God called us. For scarcely a righteous man will one die, yet perhaps for a good man someone would dare to die. You know, there's that much of a bond. You would sacrifice your life for somebody that you really care about. But said, but God demonstrated his own love towards us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Christ and the Father, by extension, took it one step further. They died for people that weren't their friends. Christ died for people that didn't even recognize the need that he needed to die for them. So then to continue, verse 9, he says, much more than having now been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from wrath through him. The wrath meaning judgment to death. Verse 10, for if when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God. That's peacemaking. And who initiated that? God did. If we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his son. Much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. And not only that, but we also rejoice in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we now have received the reconciliation. So if we've received peacemaking that allowed us to reconcile with God, then what are we to do? Reflect the same thing. If we're to become like him, we have to do like him. So let's look just a few more scriptures. Let's go back to Matthew 7. Part of this, in the peacemaking, how do we practice it, is to recognize also our own shortcomings. Oftentimes we get into conflict when we forget that we're fallible as well. As I said earlier, we oftentimes want to prove our position and you have to agree with it. So in Matthew 7, we use another example here of this hyperbole, this exaggeration for effect. And this section of Matthew, this beginning part of chapter 7, is probably some of the most misunderstood in Christianity and outside of Christianity, because the takeaway they have is that we don't judge anything. So you do you, I do me, nobody's wrong. That's not godly, even scriptural. But nonetheless, he's talking about judgment, verse 2. And this is the nut of the matter. With what judgment you judge, you will be judged. It's not about judging. It's about remembering who we are. Because oftentimes the things we get most angry about are the things that we have, right? But we think it's only someone else. You have an anger problem. How do you say politely to somebody, pot in the kettle? You know, So he goes on in verse 3 and says, why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? So this is the hyperbole. This is the exaggeration. I suspect everybody in here at some point, anybody that hears this message in a future point, you've gotten a piece of sand or, you know, an eyelash or something in your eye. It feels like glass scraping your eye, doesn't it? In fact, your eye will get really red. It'll water. It's trying to get rid of this. And you finally grab it, and it's like, man, such a small thing creating such a problem. And yet we've got a plank. We see that in someone else, but we've got this beam. You know, just a 2x4 sticking out of our eye. And that's not a problem, but the speck is. So he says, how can you say to my brother, remove the speck from your eye, and there's a plank in your own? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. We have to address ourselves first as peacemakers before we can expect anyone else to be a peacemaker. Because they may not. That's not necessarily the whole issue. The main issue is, are we? In all that we do, all that we say, the relationships we have. So then verse 5 reminds us we have to address ourselves. So let's back up to chapter 6. Again, this is all part of this context of this discourse that Christ was giving. Matthew records here chapters 5, 6, and 7. But in chapter 6, in verse 12, we're at the end of what is called the model prayer in most scriptures, because the disciples didn't even know how to pray. Their example were the Pharisees and how they prayed. That was all for show, wasn't it? So they're asking, and it's a good question to ask, how do I pray that's meaningful to the person I'm praying to? And so he says, as part of this model prayer, verse 12, that we're to ask God to forgive our debts as we forgive our debtors. So we're forgiven as we forgive, which is a pretty humbling thing to consider. And if I'm not a peacemaker, how is God viewing me in this aspect? Can he forgive me if I'm not willing to forgive other people? Because we all have feet of clay, don't we? We can forget that, though, and we can think we're better than we are. But God tells us to forgive and to cover the sins of others. He's not talking about ignoring negative ramifications, ignoring how it violates God's law. He's not talking about that. What he's talking about is allowing each other room to change. Right? I cover a sin by not making it public, by not making a public deal out of it, so that when you grow out of that, that's not your reputation. Everybody should love that, right? That you've got friends that kind of cover. They can privately come and say, and quit being such a knucklehead, right? You're being stupid. Don't do that. But it's not public embarrassment, is it? Let's go back, Matthew 5, verse 21. Christ here is talking about the intent of murder. And there have been probably billions of people who have killed in the way that Christ is talking about here, as opposed to literally taking a life, which is more damaging. Christ points out that it's how we do from the heart, because he says, verse 21, you have heard it said to those of old, you shall not murder. That's the sixth commandment, right? Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5. And he says, whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment, because you took it, I took it upon myself to decide this person is not worth leaving alive. That's not my right to choose. Christ then, but I say, so he's not setting aside the commandment. He said, you've heard that. He's going to expand on it here, the spirit and the intent. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without cause shall be in danger of the judgment. But if we're not careful, this is where human nature justifies ourselves. But I had cause. No. No, you thought you had cause. Whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. The inference in the Greek is that you're saying this person has no value. Right? You're not, you're just taking up space. That's not a judgment we can make. So to the point, so much so that in verse 23, he says, therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, which we are supposed to do, right? We're obligated to honor God, worship him in the manner that he decides. We come before him, as with, to use an illustration in modern sense, we come to him on the Sabbath or the holy days. We bring an offering in terms of our presence, our desire to learn, or even money, as we do instead of animals or sacrifices in that way. So he says, if you're bringing that and you remember that your brother has something against you, we can flip that and make it even more personal and say, you remember that you have something against someone else, right? Here's what he says to do, verse 24, leave your gift, therefore, before the altar. It is so important to reconcile and to have peace. God says, pause what you're doing for me. Go fix that. Then come. Let's continue. Leave your gift before the offer. Go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother. Then come and offer your gift. That's pretty powerful to think about. That God is so desirous of this peace, and he knows the danger of not having it, and by contrast, having it, what it brings, that he says, pause what you're doing for me. And make sure this is done first. We have other great examples of things that we could add to this. In Colossians 3, it talks about forgiving one another. Forgiveness is not so much for the other person as much as it is for us. We give ourselves permission, set it down, walk away. It doesn't have to drive us, doesn't have to define us. And then we have in Proverbs 15:1, where David tells us that a soft answer turns away wrath. Okay, so we can start at different levels. I mean, a soft answer, at the very least, can change the whole dynamics. I did this once at a job I had. It involved a process that I didn't fully understand. I was doing artwork, but the way the artwork was used was in etching. Well, you have to allow for the etching process because that's removal of material, to etch out whatever you're etching. And so I was just playing with some drawings, putting different thicknesses on it that would change how much etching was done on the piece. Well, the problem was I used somebody else's artwork. Now, it wasn't going anywhere. It was going in the scrap pile when I was done with it. I just wanted to see what it looked like so I'd better understand. This person got very offended, very angry at me, to the point where I don't think anybody in the building could not hear him. He was yelling so loud. And I remembered Psalm 15:1, and I just quietly answered and told him what I was doing. He did not know what to do with that. He wanted the volume back to justify his anger, and I didn't give it to him. We have other examples in Scripture. You know, David forgiving Nabal. You remember the account? David had protected Nabal's flocks. His herdsmen had been a blessing to him, he said. He just wanted some food and supplies and thought, well, I've done so much for Nabal. Certainly he'll give me a little bit back. And Nabal was beyond disrespectful, wasn't he? He deliberately shamed the men David sent. And when they came back to David, David was not happy. And if you remember what David wanted to do, scorched earth, kill them all. We're just going to kill them all. David would have done it. But then he meets Abigail. She quickly, you know, hustled out and said, Nabal is his name, which means a fool. What parent would name their child Nabal? But anyway, maybe it was a name he took on. But she basically said, don't do this. It's not necessary. God will take care of it. And God did, didn't he? Short time later, Nabal just dies. Okay, David didn't have to even get involved. How many times was Paul stoned and beaten? And the things that he went through, the most amazing example of me is when he was stoned, they thought he was dead. They took his body and threw it on the trash heap out of town. He gets up and then does what? Goes back in, you know, sort of the thing. And another thing, he wasn't done yet. But he wasn't there to agitate them further, was he? He simply continued what he was doing. All right, let's conclude in John 15. To be clear, I am not giving this sermon because there are major problems or issues. This is just a reminder to us all. It's the world we live in, right? There is so much anger and animosity, and people are so thin-skinned and short-fused. We need these reminders, even with each other. So in John 15, in verse 5, Christ says this, I am the vine. This was probably read, this section of Scripture was probably read at Passover a few short weeks ago. We can't live outside the vine, can we? You prune a branch, that branch dies. It's not connected to the tree. A vine, a stem you cut off, right? We have to stay connected to the source. And Christ says, I am the source. I am the vine. He says, a branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it lives in the vine. Neither can you unless you live in me. Verse 5, sorry, that's where I meant to start. I am the vine, you are the branches. He who lives in me and I in him. So the final thing I'll say in this sermon regarding peacemaking is, we cannot have peace if we're not living in Christ. He says it right here. You will not have fruit unless you live in me and I in you. So he says, if you do, you bear much fruit, for without me you can do nothing. This is why Isaiah 59 is so true. The world as a whole doesn't live in Christ. That's not their focus. That's not their understanding at this point. They will have it at the right time in the future. But peacemaking is not fully possible on a human level. But it is with Christ living in us. The cult peacemaker was responsible for far too many deaths in the West. But rather than wielding a peacemaker to impose our will on someone else, let us wield the peace of God so that we will truly be called peacemakers.